Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, May 4th, 2025. From the New York Times, posted 2 days ago, May 2nd, 2025. Trump proposes slashing domestic spending to the lowest level of the modern era. The president's $1.7 trillion budget blueprint would cut $163 billion for the 2026 fiscal year. Many of the proposed budget cuts would affect science and science research. The proposed budget would shift NASA's focus away from space science and toward the moon and Mars. Under President Trump's proposed budget, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration would largely become the National Moon and Mars Administration, with an almost singular focus on getting astronauts to those two destinations. The Trump administration proposes a budget of $18.8 billion for NASA, down 24% from $24.8 billion in the current budget year. The plan would introduce $1 billion in new investments for Mars, which would aim to fulfill Mr. Trump's pledge during his address to Congress in March to plant a flag on Mars. In the proposed budget change by agency, base discretionary funding change 2025 to 2026, the National Science Foundation's percentage cut would be 56%, the Environmental Protection Agency 54%, Health and Human Services 26%, NASA 24%, and Agriculture an 18% cut. President Trump is also proposing to cut by $2.4 billion, a program that offers low-cost financing for water quality projects. The program had gotten a major boost under President Biden's infrastructure law, but the money has been heavily earmarked by the Congress for projects that are ultimately not repaid into the program and bypass states' interest in planning, President Trump's request said. Trump's budget calls for deep cuts to public health programs and research. Two of his favorite targets, the National Institutes of Health and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, will have their funding cut nearly in half under the proposed budget, which also wipes out $4.1 billion that helps low-income Americans pay their heating and cooling bills. The budget blueprint, released Friday, 2 days ago, advances in hard numbers and biting words the president's assault on the nation's universities, but also, more importantly, on this program, Scientific Research Enterprise. It calls the NIH, or National Institutes of Health, the world's premier biomedical research agency, too big and unfocused, and proposes to cut its funding to $27 billion from roughly $48 billion, a stark contrast from its heyday in the 1990s, when Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill agreed to double its budget over a period of 5 years. The proposal also aims to cut the budget of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration by one quarter, or about $1.5 billion. The document gives few details beyond pledging to eliminate grants related to climate change. But an internal document leaked last month suggested the White House would try to eliminate the entire Oceanic and Atmospheric Research Office, potentially affecting research on subjects like early warning systems for natural disasters, science education, and the study of the Arctic. The proposal aims to cut the Department of Energy's annual budget by $4.7 billion, mainly by cutting programs related to renewable energy and climate change. But even more significantly, the proposal aims to cancel roughly $15 billion in clean energy funding that the agency was given as part of the 2021 bipartisan infrastructure bill. That would mean rescinding funds for, among other things, battery manufacturing, technologies that can remove carbon dioxide from the air, and electric vehicle charging. President Trump's budget proposal cuts $129 million from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, which focuses on improving patient safety and the overall quality of healthcare services, saying much of the work is wasteful or duplicative. The Interior Department, which manages millions of acres of public lands and water, is slated for a 30.5% overall cut, according to the budget. The Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, conservation programs are slated to lose $198 million in cuts. One thing the budget does preserve is the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Health, which was initiated in 2022 under the Biden administration. It gives grants to scientists to pursue high-risk, high-reward medical research, like studying ways to get cartilage to grow back when people develop osteoarthritis. And finally, the proposal aims to slash the budget for the National Science Foundation by more than 50% to $3.9 billion from $8.8 billion in 2025. The largest area affected is general research and education, including spending for climate, clean energy, and woke social, behavioral, and economic sciences, as well as programs the budget vaguely classifies as low-priority areas of science. All programs supported by the NSF concerning diversity, equity, and inclusion in the sciences are proposed to be eliminated, but funding for artificial intelligence and quantum information science is purported to remain the same. Michelle Roos, executive director of the Environmental Protection Network, a coalition of former EPA employees, called the budget plan short-sighted and, quote, a wrecking ball approach that would gut America's frontline defense for protecting people's health and the environment. 3 days ago, The Washington Post posted an article entitled, Amid Doge-Induced Turmoil, National Science Foundation in Crisis. The $9 billion agency exists entirely to fund science researchers, projects, and facilities outside its Alexandria, Virginia headquarters. It's had to hit reverse on its main mission. The article is written by Carolyn Y. Johnson and Joel Etchenbach. From Antarctic research stations to telescopes high in the Andes to research submarines miles below the waves, and in laboratories and classrooms across the United States, the fingerprint of the National Science Foundation is vast and consequential. The 75-year-old government agency has one function: keep the U.S. science enterprise at the leading edge. In the last 2 weeks, however, the $9 billion agency, which exists entirely to fund science researchers, projects, and facilities outside its Alexandria, Virginia headquarters, hit reverse on its main mission. NSF has been forced to cancel more than 1,000 active research grants. Funding for new research has slowed to a crawl, as the agency has awarded half the number of grants since President Donald Trump's inauguration, compared to the same period in 2024, according to a Washington Post analysis of the NSF grants database. On top of that, officials are running budget scenarios of drastic cuts for next year. And now there's a leadership vacuum. Last week, NSF director abruptly resigned, writing in an email to staff, "I have done all I can." NSF funds basic research, research that is mentioned in every article I read on this program. The kinds of questions sparked by curiosity that may have no clear application and little interest from corporations or philanthropies, but can deepen our understanding of nature, spawn new industries, and change the world. An NSF-funded observatory was the first to detect ripples in space-time, predicted by Albert Einstein. NSF's basic research into circuits and transistors helped advance the chips that power modern technology. Some 268 Nobel laureates have received funding from the agency. The first months of this president's second presidency have been marked by the unraveling of an historic relationship between research institutions and federal government. That partnership, forged in the wake of World War II, has powered American science preeminence. At the National Institutes of Health, the funding of science has been massively slowed by a multi-pronged attack on the process of awarding new grants, as well as an unprecedented effort to terminate existing awards. Now, that same playbook is unfolding at National Science Foundation. The National Science Foundation is modeling various budget scenarios. A spokesman for NSF declined to answer specific questions, referring to a fact sheet that describes the agency's changing priorities. The U.S. science machine that is the envy of the world is about to be wrecked. Michael Turner, a cosmologist at the University of California at Los Angeles, said in an email, "If we go down the route of dismantling the great American science machine, we will suffer the consequences in all aspects of life." In his goodbye letter, the outgoing director alluded to attempts to cut the agency. "While NSF has always been an efficient agency, we still took the challenge of identifying other possible efficiencies and reducing our commitments to serve the scientific community even better," he wrote. "NSF is an extremely important investment to make U.S. scientific dominance a reality. We must not lose our competitive edge. A thoughtful approach to efficiencies and investments is incredibly important. I believe that I have done all I can to advance the mission of the agency." He was nominated as NSF director in the first Trump administration, and his six-year term was not set to end until the middle of 2026. While serving under President Joe Biden, Panchanathan oversaw new initiatives mandated in congressional legislation to broaden the impact of and participation in science. Researchers seeking grants have been required to describe how their work would advance those goals. Such efforts, which seek to diversify the demographics of the scientific community, historically dominated by white males, also are designed to expand funding for research in institutions in rural America and far from the coasts. But the return of Trump put much of this in reverse. One of his first actions was banning the use of federal money for DEI research. NSF officials immediately complied, launching keyword-triggered reviews of grants, mining the agency's vast research portfolio for topics the administration no longer wanted to support, including DEI and gender ideology. The immediate compliance with Trump's executive orders was viewed as a betrayal by many of his own employees. He went on to fire 10% of NSF's probationary employees, despite internal anger, a blow that was later partly reversed. According to multiple NSF employees who spoke on the condition of anonymity and shared screenshots, known U.S. DOGE service employees were recently added to the NSF staff directory database. Funding started to get held up. Then, in two tranches of cancellations, more than 1,000 grants were terminated, most of them focused on DEI. Also targeted are misinformation and disinformation research programs. NSF has been the focus of Republican ire in recent years. Last year, Senator Ted Cruz, a Republican from Texas, released a staff report that claimed to have identified 3,483 NSF grants totaling more than $2 billion that promoted DEI tenets or pushed onto science neo-Marxist perspectives about enduring class struggle. The Democratic staff of the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee responded this year with its own report, saying the Cruz report contained embarrassing mistakes, such as flagging grants focused on biodiversity. At best, the Cruz report is a sloppy mess that should be viewed as nothing more than the political hit job it is, the report said. Nicholas George, a biology major at Florida State University, was crushed when he got an email less than 2 weeks ago before graduation with the news that his year-long research opportunity at Oklahoma State University, an on-ramp to science for recent college graduates set to start in June 1st, was canceled. For George, this program would have been the next step toward a scientific career. He hoped to study the genetics and physiology of anole lizards in response to novel climates and environments. George had turned down other opportunities. He'd told friends and family he'd been preparing to move. "It's definitely very discouraging," George said. "Even talking to my current research mentor and grad students in my lab, they're like, any day you could get an email because you never know when that funding security is going to be taken away." While many of the grants canceled have been focused on smaller scale projects, Alondra Nelson, a member of the National Science Board, which oversees the National Science Foundation, said they would have a long-term impact. These accounts of how we are decimating with 1,000 cuts the science and research ecosystem are devastating. It's sort of cutting off the future. The grant terminations at NSF may not be legal, said Representative Zoe Lofgren of California, the leading Democrat of the Science Committee. And if the Trump administration does, as has been speculated, push through drastic cuts to the budgets of NSF and other science agencies, it will be a disaster, she said. The vast majority of GDP growth in the United States is related to science and technology investments, and now we're crushing it, Lofgren said. There's plenty of things that could be made better at NSF. That's different from gutting the agency. And the larger flagship research infrastructure NSF runs, its telescopes, its observatories, its South Pole operations, will also be on the chopping block if extreme budget cuts are enacted, according to multiple people familiar with planning scenarios. If the agency is operating at 50% capacity, how should the agency approach hard strategic decisions? Do we start shutting down astronomical observatories? Do we turn off all of Antarctic operations? Said a person familiar with the agency's governance. You have to look at the biggest ticket items. And this article on the future of the National Science Foundation, if cuts to the agency proposed in the budget blueprint come to fruition, appeared in the Washington Post 3 days ago. From the latest issue of EOS, published by the AGU, the American Geophysical Union, the May 2025 issue. Delegations Drive One Water Dialogues by Grace Van Dielen. Proactive approaches allow water practitioners to address issues in innovative, inclusive ways. On a summer morning, a storm dropped buckets of rain on the desert outside Tucson, Arizona. Water ran over the dry soil. Most of the water subsequently evaporated, but some parched plants drank their fill. What was left over sank into the ground, percolating into the aquifer below. A few kilometers down the road, Tucson Water pumped groundwater from the same aquifer to a nearby reservoir, then through its treatment system. A Tucson ratepayer turned on her tap and used a few liters of water to give her dog a bath. The soiled water flowed into Tucson's wastewater system and once again was treated. A portion of that recycled wastewater was released into the Santa Cruz River, where parkgoers enjoyed watching it flow through the city. In Tucson, as in the rest of the world, every human interaction with water is connected to a broader water system. But water practitioners haven't always treated their work with the same interconnected approach. Instead, many cities and regions divide their water into three silos: drinking water, wastewater, and storm water, each managed separately. That approach is not meeting the needs of many communities, and a different approach called One Water is beginning to take its place. One Water treats drinking water, wastewater, and storm water as a single, interconnected entity and attempts to manage it holistically, bringing together water utilities, community members, business and industry leaders, researchers, politicians, engineers, and advocacy groups. In a One Water approach, the Tucson ratepayer, water utility, and parkgoer are equal stakeholders, and water practitioners attempt to create a water system that works well for each of them. Partnerships and collaboration are at its core, said Scott Berry, Director of Policy and Government Affairs at the U.S. Water Alliance, a nonprofit membership organization dedicated to advancing a One Water future for all. A holistic, inclusive approach is not without obstacles, though. Different stakeholders bring different priorities and practices and may have cultural, historical, regulatory, and organizational barriers that keep them from collaborating effectively. To navigate such challenges, water stakeholders from varied sectors across the United States come together at an annual conference, soon to be held every 18 months, the One Water Summit, hosted by the U.S. Water Alliance. About 70% of attendees come as part of a delegation, a peer group, typically organized by region, whose members want to work together on U.S. water issues. These delegations are the lifeblood of the summit and uniquely mirror the One Water approach. They're meant to be highly collaborative, allowing stakeholders with very different priorities to come together and work toward a common cause. Though the framework is hindered by funding constraints and a lack of engagement from some sectors, delegations have provided a valuable opportunity for sharing knowledge and bringing One Water projects to fruition. Siloed systems. In the water sector, siloed systems are the norm. The inertia they engender can be hard to break when trying to build collaborative networks. In some cases, siloed approaches contribute to unaligned regulations, which can limit a collaboration's success, explained Katie Peterson, a research fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California's Water Policy Center. For example, someone working on a wastewater problem must navigate both environmental and health regulations. A One Water program might involve potable reuse or recycling wastewater into drinking water by purifying it, filtering it, and diverting it to groundwater or reservoir supplies. Such a project needs to ensure that the recycled water complies with environmental regulations that govern water quality for irrigation and other non-potable uses. But once that water is destined for a drinking water supply, it must also comply with health regulations. A little bit of streamlining of those regulations can bolster collaboration, Peterson said. Siloed jurisdictions can present another challenge for water practitioners. Though the flow of water respects no political or system boundary, water managers do work within such jurisdictions, said Saren Pokhrel, a water resource engineer for the Environment and Protected Areas Ministry of Alberta, Canada. Some local governments within Alberta, such as Edmonton, where Pokhrel is based, use a One Water approach. British Columbia, where Pokhrel previously worked, is home to an array of jurisdictions. Municipalities govern water via local bylaws, Indigenous communities manage their own water, and districts follow broader regional plans. Unifying plans under a single framework that all levels of water management can follow is very challenging, he said. The U.S. Water Alliance added the delegation structure to its annual conference in 2016 as a way for water practitioners to overcome these barriers and move toward One Water ideals. Barry, who leads delegation work at the U.S. Water Alliance, said he thinks of the delegation system as an opportunity for stakeholders to road test collaborations. It's this idea of getting a bunch of folks together who may not work together often or who may even be at odds with one another, he said. It's a way to test the waters of collaboration away from the normal sphere of influence. Organizers of the One Water Summit encourage delegations, which can be assembled by anyone with the interest, ability, and time, to recruit fellow delegates to attend. Delegation members can register at a discounted rate, and the summit provides opt-in programming specifically for delegates. Around 1,000 people and 20 to 40 delegations attend each year. Membership in any one delegation has ranged from fewer than 10 to almost 50 people, Barry said. The first half day of each summit is dedicated to peer exchanges, where delegations present their work to each other. These presentations range from showcasing a particular success to workshopping a problem that the delegation is facing, Barry said. At the 2023 Tucson Summit, for example, the Tap Into Resilience delegation hosted a peer exchange to brainstorm how to scale up distributed water infrastructure, a type of ultra-local water system meant to be more affordable than conventional water systems. The Climate Action Delegation shared strategies for utilities to use capital investments to make progress on their climate plans. And the New Jersey delegates hosted a discussion about how delegations can build relationships with state governments to advance OneWater. At an end of summit plenary, delegations are invited to announce commitments to action for the coming year. The entire plenary, you're surrounded by all this amazing work that's going to be happening in all these different places, Barry said. You get a sense that you're not alone and that there are opportunities for collaboration. Commitments to action range from informal directives to full proposals. Delegations at the 2023 summit committed to developing new One Water plans for their cities, improving community engagement around water issues, sharing what they learned with local leaders and policymakers, and constructing new green stormwater and water treatment facilities. Delegations that return to the subsequent summit are encouraged to share how they've progressed on their commitments. One Water, Many Networks. Water practitioners report a strengthening of the depth and breadth of their collaborations as a result of participating in a delegation. I felt like I really got to know people in a different way, and not just as colleagues, but as friends, said Rebecca Jones, Communications Director for the Iowa Soybean Association's Iowa Agriculture Water Alliance, who attended the 2023 One Water Summit as part of the delegation from Iowa. Jones deepened her relationships with colleagues at the City of Cedar Rapids and Des Moines Waterworks, and especially enjoyed meeting members of a delegation from Hawaii, who shared how critical water is to Hawaiian culture and livelihoods. Jennifer Walker of the Texas delegation, director of the Texas Coast and Water Program at the National Wildlife Federation, said she feels the same after attending multiple summits. When a delegation convenes away from their home community, everybody has a little bit more time to focus on the content, spend some time together, and build relationships, she said. Because Texas is such a large state, the delegation venue is crucial for getting Texas stakeholders, including nonprofits, utilities, engineers, consultants, elected officials, and community members in the same room. The delegation are building relationships among people who don't work together day to day, said Michelle Stockness, executive director of the Freshwater Society, a nonprofit based in St. Paul, Minnesota. Stockness attended the 2023 summit as a member of the Minnesota delegation. We are building these relationships so that we can talk about hard things a little more easily. We can come together in ways that would be almost impossible at home, said Candace Ruprecht, a water conservation program manager for the City of Tucson and member of the Tucson delegation, in a 2019 presentation. Strengthened relationships have sparked meaningful progress on One Water projects across the country. At the 2023 conference, the Iowa delegation held an educational session about urban and rural collaboration via an exercise about a fictional town called Farmersville and its picturesque Crystal River. Attendees attempted to fix a water quality problem in Farmersville, a suddenly odorous and murky Crystal River, while playing a role that was different from their real-life job. For example, a water researcher could act as mayor, and a utility staff member could role-play a farmer. In the scenario, the urban community blamed rural farmers for soil erosion and nutrient pollution, whereas farmers accused the city of industrial pollution and ineffective waste management. Workshop attendees had to navigate these concerns as they developed a plan to improve water quality. It got people thinking out of the box about what it's like to be in someone else's shoes, Jones said. In New Jersey, water practitioners had already formed a coalition of community members, nonprofit organizations, government entities, and utilities when the delegation from the state began attending the summit in 2016. Participating as a delegation supplemented the group's holistic effort, said Paula Figueroa, director of the Jersey Water Works Collaborative and a former New Jersey delegate. For the New Jersey delegation, the summit is an important source of energy to balance the sometimes draining, difficult work of advancing a One Water approach, she said. After the 2022 summit, Figueroa noticed that two leaders, one a New Jersey utility staff member and the other an employee of the Jersey Waterworks Collaborative, began to collaborate inviting each other to more events, and sharing the other's work. The new relationship increased the visibility of a shared primary project, replacing lead service lines across the state. The summit offers delegations opportunities for interstate cooperation as well. Following conversations between the Pittsburgh and Milwaukee delegations at the 2022 and 2023 summits, delegates from Pennsylvania and Wisconsin held a dedicated learning exchange in Milwaukee the following year. Some water issues in Pittsburgh would have taken 2 or 3 years each to solve, but as a result of knowledge gained in the Wisconsin exchange, we were able to complete 5 or 6 problems in 2 or 3 years, said Jamil Bey, founder of the Urbankind Institute and a longtime member of the Pittsburgh delegation. That learning exchange model is really helpful. The event in Milwaukee helped inform a new approach to assessing and addressing stormwater reclamation in Pittsburgh, for instance, said Kelly Henderson, who was part of the Pittsburgh cohort that attended the learning exchange. One of the locations the group visited was Green Tech Station, a former brownfield site that the Northwest Side Community Development Corporation, a nonprofit in Milwaukee, had transformed into a stormwater reclamation facility. Green Tech Station can capture more than 380,000 liters of stormwater each time it rains, water that is then used to irrigate trees on the site. The facility also includes a prairie ecosystem with native plants, a pavilion to host educational programming, and a collection of artwork. Henderson, executive director of Grounded Strategies, a nonprofit focused on community-driven vacant lot reclamation, found Green Tech Station so inspiring that she decided to create something similar in Pittsburgh. Grounded Strategies, along with partners from the Department of City Planning in Pittsburgh and the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority and elsewhere, recently received a $55,000 grant to start the project. As they plan the site, they'll be in close contact with a group that constructed Green Tech Station, Henderson said. Delegations can also facilitate cooperation between stakeholders with different immediate interests. In 2017, for example, the Tucson delegation committed to a lofty goal, returning perennial water flow to the Santa Cruz River. At the time, the stretch of the river in downtown Tucson flowed only during rainstorms. Ruprecht, the Tucson Water Conservation Manager and four-time Tucson delegation member, said delegation members were key to advocating for Arizona's drought contingency plan, a change in state law that increased recycled water recharge credits. Under the drought contingency plan, Tucson Water can receive credits for 95% of the water released into the Santa Cruz River, then use those credits in the future to secure additional water supply. Within a year, Tucson Water's Santa Cruz River Heritage Project had released enough recycled water to the river that it flowed anew for the first time in almost 80 years. The new stretch of perennial river restored plants, revitalized a cienega, a wetland ecosystem, and provided new habitat for wildlife such as herons, native toads, coyotes, and dragonflies. Inclusivity obstacles. Though many delegations have made tangible progress toward One Water goals, barriers still exist to achieving full cross-sector engagement. With something like One Water, if you don't do a good job of building those relationships and building those ties between sectors, then there's a risk it could be just some pleasant marketing, but not really delivering the outcomes that it's supposed to deliver, Peterson said. One major barrier is money. Attending the summit comes at a financial cost that can be too high for underfunded organizations. It's all about money, said Pockrell, the Alberta engineer. Do we have enough budget? Do we have enough resources to fulfill this? Most of the most vulnerable people who are having water issues, they don't have the resources to participate, Bay said. There's a minimum threshold for organizational capacity that you have to connect you to these types of conversations. The U.S. Water Alliance tries to help delegates from underfunded organizations attend the summit with a tiered registration fee system. If you're a small nonprofit, you're going to pay less than a private company or a large urban utility, Barry said. The people who are more resourced, who can afford to pay more, do pay more. And that helps us subsidize the cost for the folks who are less well-resourced. A little funding can go a long way to help include historically marginalized voices. With help from a grant from the U.S. Water Alliance, for instance, in 2023, the Minnesota delegation was able to invite representatives from the indigenous-led nonprofit Honor the Earth, as well as community members from the Environmental Justice Coordinating Council, or EJCC. Members of EJCC had previously attended the 2022 One Water Summit in Milwaukee, where they had committed to working on issues of environmental health in Minnesota, particularly the impact of PER and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, on drinking water. Providing funding for community and tribal members was really important to get the people we wanted to be there and have that diverse representation of multiple perspectives, Stockness said. Delegates from Honor the Earth and EJCC could not be reached for comment in time for publication. Barry and some past delegates said they feel that the agriculture industry is underrepresented at the summits, too. Agriculture is a huge element of the water system, responsible for about 70% of freshwater use worldwide. The proportion of agriculture practitioners at the summit is still not as big as it could be or should be, said Sean McMahon, a sustainable agriculture consultant who has been involved in coordinating the Iowa delegation for five summits. City utilities make up the majority of membership in the U.S. Water Alliance, and urban organizations dominate the summit, a dynamic that may make the rural agriculture community feel ostracized, Peterson said. If members of the agriculture community are not engaging in a collaboration, that might mean the benefit of participating is not clear to them. As in the fictional Farmersville, agriculture communities and urban water suppliers may not always see eye to eye. Farmers may be frustrated with what they see as overly restrictive regulations in an already difficult economic environment, whereas urban utilities prioritize delivering clean drinking water to their ratepayers. The agriculture sector often gets cast as a villain and may feel that it must defend itself against other water practitioners who aren't familiar with the hardships of farm operations, Peterson said. Making clear to farmers the mutual benefits of a one-water approach could improve collaboration. For instance, many sustainable agricultural practices both benefit farm finances and improve downstream water quality. McMahon recommended that delegation leaders reach out to agriculture associations to find champions of improving water quality and water use efficiency. If you're framing your proposal like, "Come help us talk about these complicated issues from your perspective," it's like a wide open door to have really powerful conversations, said Jones. Claire Lindahl, Chief Executive Officer of the Soil and Water Conservation Society, a member of the Soil and Water Conservation Delegation, and a board member of the U.S. Water Alliance, said her delegation has had success building relationships across the urban and rural divide by emphasizing the value of water to all stakeholders. The water is the bridge, she said. When a highly diverse group of stakeholders makes it to the summit, collaborations can lead to what Figueroa called a healthy push and pull. Everyone sitting around the table may have different expectations, goals, and work practices. Delegations have found that defining common goals and outlining clear responsibilities are the best way around that. For example, the New Jersey group has centered its conversations around four shared goals: having effective and financially sustainable water systems, empowering stakeholders and ensuring that they are well-informed, building successful beneficial green infrastructure, and creating smart combined sewer overflow control systems. That's our North Star, and that has helped us, Figueroa said. It's hard to break down silos if your objectives aren't clear, Peterson said. Being really candid and clear about who's involved, what the roles are, and what the responsibilities are for the beginning, middle, and end of the project can help, she said. Barry said he has high hopes for the future of delegations. He imagines an eventual Colorado River delegation that would include stakeholders from throughout the Colorado River Basin. Other dreams include a Great Lakes delegation and a Mississippi River delegation. There's so much ground to cover, he said. It's both a resources and money question, and it's a relationship question, Barry said. And this article, Delegations Drive One Water Dialogues. Proactive approaches allow water practitioners to address issues in innovative, inclusive ways, appears in the May 2025 issue of EOS, published by the AGU, or American Geophysical Union. Next, the March 2025 issue of Science News, an article that is part of a series on what happens after the California fires. This one is written by Nick Ogasa, a staff writer for Science News, and he is no stranger to covering wildfires. It all started in 2020 when he was a graduate student at the University of California, Santa Cruz. The CZU Lightning Complex fires had spread across the mountains near campus, and Ogasa wrote about the calamity. It was then that he learned about the dangers of massive waves of debris-laced mud that can occur after wildfires. That's a problem because debris flows can strike suddenly, he says. So when devastating infernos erupted in the Los Angeles area in January of this year, he got to reporting on researchers' efforts to assess the debris flow risk. The process was emotionally challenging for Ogasa, who is from Southern California and has family there. But, he says, writing about the fires helped me by making me feel that I was contributing somehow, and that made me feel a little less helpless. The next risk, landslides. In the section called From the Ashes, the LA wildfires were still burning when scientists began scouting the freshly charred burn scars to search for signs of another potential danger, roaring torrents of rock and mud and water that can sweep downhill with deadly momentum. Triggered by intense rainfall, these debris flows become more likely after an intense wildfire has scorched an area's slopes. At least half of their volume is sediment, and it's mixed with burned trees, cars, and boulders. It's like concrete moving downhill, says geologist Jamie Kostelnik of the U.S. Geological Survey in Golden, Colorado. Debris flows can carry a lot of material and can swell to five times as high as a flash flood, she says. Basically, a flood on steroids. Debris flows can hit speeds of about 56 kilometers per hour as they careen through valleys, canyons, and stream channels. Some gain so much momentum that they carve new paths. Due to their quick and powerful nature, debris flows can be devastating. In January 2018, debris flows in Montecito, California, killed 23 people and damaged or destroyed over 400 homes just a month after the Thomas Fire started. The mountainous areas of Los Angeles County are known for debris flows after blazes like the 2009 Station Fire and 2016 San Gabriel Complex Fire, both of which were near the recent Eaton Fire. The steep terrain and the fact that California is in its wet season leads us to believe that the level of hazard is going to be quite high, Kostelnik says. Spurred by the threat, she and other scientists began assessing the extent to which the LA wildfires primed the landscape for debris flows, even as new flames roared to life. The findings will inform decisions about when and where to warn people about the hazard. That's crucial, because avoiding debris flows is the only way to stay safe. Researchers from federal and state agencies have been surveying the areas burned by the Palisades and Eaton fires, the two largest, as well as the smaller Kenneth and Hurst fires. The field teams first study satellite imagery from before and after the areas burned for changes in vegetation cover. As flames devour leaf litter, the underlying soil loses a protective layer that shields it from erosion by rainfall. That loss is exacerbated if standing vegetation that hampers water flowing across the ground is also incinerated, and the destruction of root systems unbinds dirt and rocks, making them easier to move. Then there's how the fires alter the soil, the dirt. Gases released by burning vegetation can seep into the ground and condense into a waxy substance. The wax prevents water from percolating into the soil, resulting in more runoff on the surface, and heat can disaggregate soil particles, promoting erosion. Following a fire, it can take just a brief bout of rainfall to trigger a flash flood, and if the rushing water picks up enough sediment, it can evolve into a debris flow. These things can happen within minutes of a rainstorm, Kostelnik says. Guided by these satellite images, the teams entered the burned areas and sampled the soils of those most severely burned, says Jeremy Lancaster, a geologist who scouted the Palisades and Eaton burn scars. In each scar, teams assess how deeply and intensely the fires had burned the soil. We are typically worried about moderate to high burn severity, says Lancaster of the California Department of Conservation. In moderately burned areas, up to 80% of litter has been burned and surface roots may have been killed, while high severity areas have no litter or surface roots remaining. The Eaton and Palisades fires burned areas had burned mostly at moderate severity and hydrophobic soil layers had formed. Between the two fire areas, the Eaton fire's burn scar appears to pose greater risk for debris flows. The Eaton fire area has extremely steep watersheds, sloping down into Altadena, Pasadena, all the way out to Monrovia, Lancaster says. The team's observations have helped generate publicly available maps showing where debris flow hazard is greatest. Those maps will later inform decisions by officials to issue alerts and evacuation orders. Emergency planners try to anticipate debris flows using the maps and weather forecasts. They watch for storms that could drop over a centimeter of rain in 30 minutes or over a half centimeter in 15 minutes on severely burned slopes. Debris flows become much more likely at these rates, says hydrologist Jamie Labor of the National Weather Service in Oxnard, California. About 12 to 36 hours before a storm, the National Weather Service may issue a watch alert if the forecast rainfall could trigger debris flows. Once the storm has arrived, the NWS may warn that debris flows are imminent. Don't wait for the warning because it could be 0 minutes of lead time, Labor says. The watch alert is the best time to take action. Evacuations can be exhausting, especially for people displaced by the fires. Complicating the anxiety is the fact that debris flow risk can stay heightened for 2 to 5 years after a fire, Labor says. It's been really dry, so it might take a couple more years before LA really starts to recover. And a photograph shows the anatomy of a debris flow. Sloped landscapes severely burned by wildfire are at high risk for debris flows after intense bouts of rain, shown in this illustration. The flames alter soil, making it prone to erosion. First, we see a pre-wildfire hill slope, where we find intact litter layers, plants, and root systems. Then we have the wildfire-induced changes in soil and vegetation cover. The litter layer and plants are destroyed, and the soil forms a waxy layer. And then we have the rainfall-triggered debris flow in burned areas. The runoff and erosion due to hydrophobic soil causes debris flow. This article, The Next Risk, Landslides, appears in the March 2025 issue of Science News, which focuses on the aftermath of the California fires. The parts of LA affected by wildfires have different water concerns. Water in the form of rain can trigger landslides, on the steep coastal slopes. But even before fires and rain, landslides have been an issue in California. From the New York Times climate section, posted on February 19, 2025, and written by Austin Gaffney and Harry Stevens, a slow-moving California landslide suddenly speeds up. A new map shows where land movement is accelerating, buckling roads and collapsing homes. Along the sparkling coast of Southern California, a string of landslides creeping toward the sea has transformed the wealthy community of Rancho Palos Verdes into a disaster zone. New data from a NASA plane shows the widening threat of these slow-moving landslides, which have destabilized homes, businesses, and infrastructure, like roads and utilities. Researchers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or JPL, documented how the landslides have pushed westward, almost doubling in area since the state mapped them in 2007. The landslides have also sped up in recent years. A month of aerial radar images taken by NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, in the fall, revealed how land in the Palos Verdes Peninsula slid toward the ocean by as much as 4 inches each week between mid-September and mid-October of last year. Before that, a city report showed more than a foot of weekly movement in July and August of last year. And a map shows the landslide boundary in 2007, and then the boundary in 2024. It is more than doubled in size. The massive slides in Los Angeles County, known as the Greater Portuguese Bend Landslide Complex, reactivated in 1956 after road construction destabilized the once dormant slope. For decades, it slid just a few inches every year. But heavy rain in 2023 and early 2024 accelerated that movement, leading Governor Gavin Newsom to declare a state of emergency, citing conditions of extreme peril to the safety of persons and property. Homes in Rancho Palos Verdes began collapsing in June and August of 2023. Streets have fissured, walls have shifted, and floors have cracked open to reveal the dynamic earth below. A downed power line related to the slides started a small brush fire in August of last year. A $42 million buyout program helps property owners voluntarily sell and relocate, but homeowner insurance policies do not typically cover landslides. Mitigating such a disaster is extremely expensive. By the end of this fiscal year, the city said it will have spent more than $35 million, almost 90% of its general fund operations budget, on addressing the landslide. That includes the installation of 11 wells that have worked to pump out 145 million gallons of groundwater that could further destabilize the slope. The investment has yielded results. The landslide slowed by about 3% on average between December and February, that is, December of 2024 and February 2025, thanks to the wells and a lack of rain, the city said. Slow-moving slides are common around the world, and especially in California, where several hundred have been mapped in coastal mountain ranges. Normally moving at a sluggish pace, these slides can grind nearly to a halt during the dry summer months before a wet winter makes them crawl again. But last summer, the landslide complex in Rancho Palos Verdes exhibited strange behavior when it failed to slow. The best guess for why has to do with a very wet 2023, said Alexander Hahnweger, a research scientist at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, who has studied the behavior of slow-moving landslides for well over a decade. Typically triggered tens of meters underground, they remain an ongoing area of research. Of all the things we know, Dr. Hahnweger said, we know the least about what's happening under the ground. Last week, other parts of Los Angeles County faced additional landslides, ones that move quickly, running at meters per second instead of centimeters per week. The National Weather Service in Los Angeles issued warnings for post-fire debris flows, a tangle of mud, rocks, and trees that start on burn scars ahead of heavy rainfall. L.A. neighborhoods scorched by wildfires like the Eaton and Palisades fires last month faced some of the greatest dangers as those flows hit businesses and homes in Southern California. But slower-moving landslides, like the ones in Rancho Palos Verdes, are more predictable. They ooze rather than race. They typically need a season of rain rather than a single storm to accelerate, and it's extremely rare for them to suddenly collapse or slide in a catastrophic way. It's unclear what triggers that kind of sudden catastrophe, said Luke McGuire, an associate professor in geomorphology at the University of Arizona. He pointed to one of the few known examples of such an event in 2017, when the Mud Creek landslide in Big Sur gave way after 8 years of stable sliding. More than 65 feet of rocks and dirt covered a quarter mile of Highway 1, the scenic drive winding along the California coast. Experts say that the city of Rancho Palos Verdes probably will not experience that kind of sudden event. You can never say never, but the likelihood that this would go into a catastrophic movement phase is quite low, said Dave Petley, a landslide expert who collects global landslide data for the American Geophysical Union, AGU. It's likely it'll continue to cause substantial property damage, but the risk of the thing suddenly sliding into the sea and taking everyone with it is not particularly high. A 2019 Nature study by Dr. Hontveger showed that the Mud Creek landslide could have been triggered by a shift from drought to record rainfall. In a warming world, an increase in extreme rain events could cause more landslides to quicken, according to the study. More precipitation could also cause more landslides to emerge from hibernation into slow-moving slides. Rainfall under climate change can wake a landslide back up, Dr. Petley said, adding that a vast number of dormant landslides with this potential exist across the globe. And this New York Times article in the Department of Climate, "A Slow-Moving California Landslide Suddenly Speeds Up," was posted on February 19, 2025. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.